many possibilities. We can do a lot of things if we combine our power and if we really concentrate on this process.
Yes, we have the perception that climate change impact happen far away from them, in the North Pole or South Pole with the polar bear. They don't have the perception that actually climate change already happening around them.
We need to have courage as voters and as governments to move forward to actually reduce our emissions, which we have never done.
This is Forum Fedcast, Episode 9, Federalism and Climate Change, Part 2, Governance Going Green. In May 2023, the Australian Bureau of Meteorology's El Niño Monitoring Service predicted a 50% chance that the global weather phenomenon would return in 2023 or 2024. During El Niño, the surface temperatures of the waters of the Pacific Ocean become warmer than usual, causing the Pacific jet stream to move south of its neutral position. The knock-on effects typically lead to extreme heat waves in some parts of the world, and more intense and frequent rainfall in others. After 3 years of the La Niña weather pattern, 2023 has the potential to be the hottest year ever. It's likely to break the previous highest average annual global temperature, which occurred in 2016, coinciding with a strong El Niño. The record-breaking heatwave, which affected large parts of Asia in April 2023, is another sign that, even without the El Niño effect, global warming is increasing the frequency of unprecedented weather events.
Events like the Asia heatwave, other extreme weather patterns exacerbated by climate change, and the broader impacts of a warming planet present governments with a public policy challenge unlike any other. Even in countries which may consider themselves somewhat insulated from the more severe impacts, there is a recognition of the cross-cutting and interconnected effects that accompany climate change. A 2020 report to the Canadian Parliament highlighting the societal disruption which will occur cited a range of risks related to health, human rights, environment-related migration, food security, economic development and employment, national defense and security, and transportation infrastructure. With such wide-ranging impacts, governments have no choice but to work to ensure that political, social, and economic institutions can mitigate and adapt to the broader impacts of climate change.
After decades of inertia in terms of meaningful action, the warming of the planet is now something that just cannot be ignored. Governments all around the world are implementing policies and programs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and undergo green transition. In federal countries, action is being taken by both national and subnational governments. And, as we heard in the previous episode, the structure of federal systems does provide opportunities to foster progressive climate policy tailored to the distinct conditions of a particular country or region. But what kinds of specific climate change measures are being implemented in federal countries? How have the federal dynamics impacted on the policies developed? Have they been effective? And what about institutions and actors outside of government? What role do they play in supporting progressive climate governance in federations?
In this episode, the second and final part in our series on climate change and federalism, we'll take a closer look at climate governance in federal countries on four continents, getting into the nitty-gritty of the policies and politics in Canada, Germany, Malaysia, and Australia. And we'll tackle the tricky question of whether federal or unitary states produce more effective climate governance. So, sit back, stay cool, and join us for part two of our exploration of climate change and federalism.
With extreme weather events becoming increasingly common in all parts of the world, people are feeling the impacts in their everyday lives. How has this changed the perception of climate change among the general public?
I would say mainly because of the situation and the experiences of a lot of areas and the experience that the temperature is increasing and rain is much more heavier than before and all these. The consciousness in the societies has been raised.
Carsten Seeling is a former member of the National Parliament of Germany, the Bundestag, and served as the mayor of the city of Bremen from 2015 to 2019. From 2019, he was a member of the Bremen Regional Parliament's Enquete Commission, Climate Protection Strategy for the State of Bremen, which aimed to find ways of limiting the impact of climate change and protecting the natural environment in the city-state.
Of course, this was a booster for the Green parties, but other parties developed their climate policy as well. And so I would say there is a consensus that things have to be changed. Even in industry, the automotive industry is now asking for green steel because they know if they produce cars in the traditional way, maybe their customers are going to hesitate to buy these companies. And so the steel industries have to change because they have to produce in another way.
With this new public consciousness concerning climate change, what is the role of federalism in this context?
I think as we go forward, the federalism question will become less relevant.
Alan Fenner is a professor of politics at Curtin University in Western Australia.
I think it's in these last decades of high degree of political contention over the issue, when a lot of the new relevant technologies are still emergent, federalism is important because of the scope and opportunity it's provided for alternative avenues of policymaking and so on. But I think if the problem becomes more visibly acute, and at the same time there's increasingly rapid development of relevant technologies, then there will be more consensus and more ability to move forward, in which case the opportunities that federalism provides become somewhat less significant, I think.
If federalism's ability to contribute to climate change policy is currently at its most impactful, what is needed in federal systems to maximize the potential contribution of these innovations to tackling global warming?
There are many possibilities. We can do a lot of things if we combine our power in a way and if we really concentrate on this process. But therefore, you have to develop a consensus, a new consensus for changing the infrastructure. The infrastructure in power generation, the infrastructure in traffic, in the housing sector, a lot of things have to be changed. And to get a result like this, it's necessary to stick together with not just with politicians, but with the scientific area as well. And so our commission was a mixed one with scientists on the one hand and on the other hand, politicians, and all this is supported by the administrations. You also have to use the power of the society, of the companies, of course, and about the civil society as well.
Unfortunately, consensus and collective action are not easy to achieve in complex political and economic landscapes.
The Canadian case demonstrates how debates over climate policy in federations can be contested and charged. This dynamic is partially due to the political economy of fossil fuel extraction and its economic significance to supporting and maintaining the standards of living that Canadians have grown accustomed to.
Canada is a very carbon-intensive country in terms of our industries, significant economic contribution from fossil fuel production, especially oil and gas.
Catherine Harrison is a professor of political science at the University of British Columbia. She is the author of the Forum's climate governance policy paper, The Challenge of Federalism for Canadian Climate Policy.
Because we have lots of fossil fuels, we also have some fossil fuel intensive manufacturing industries, but also just at the household level, Canadians, I believe, have the most square footage per person in the world in their homes. We drive the biggest vehicles, the most gas-guzzling vehicles in the world. And we have these sprawling cities where people drive those vehicles long distances to commute to work. So a very carbon and fossil fuel intensive economy. And that makes addressing climate change challenging, whether we have a federal system or not.
Despite the challenges, Canada's federal system provided the space for provinces to develop and pursue their own innovative climate policies and initiatives at a time when the federal government was hesitant to act.
We saw kind of the positive outcome of decentralization in the late 2000s. It was a period when the federal government was reluctant to act on climate change, was resisting moving forward, and some provinces took matters into their own hands. So British Columbia adopted a carbon tax. Quebec joined in emissions trading with California, the so-called Western Climate Initiative. Ontario briefly joined that emissions trading scheme. Alberta eventually adopted a carbon tax itself. And after those provinces took matters into their own hands, the innovation didn't spill over to the other provinces. There was a truncated uptake of carbon pricing. But what did happen is, you know, almost a decade later, the federal government said, this is going to go nationwide, and adopted a national carbon pricing law that requires either that all provinces establish their own carbon price that meets certain national minimum standards, and if they don't, the feds step in and impose a carbon tax. So I think that's a very positive dynamic where we saw leadership at the subnational level filling a vacuum that existed at the time, and eventually it spread nationally.
This example of subnational action in Canada demonstrates the possible national benefits that can be gained from provincial policy autonomy over climate change. But, as Catherine explains, this process is not without difficulties, as provinces are sometimes reluctant to accept national interventions. This presents a problem when there is a preference for consensus, as there is in Canada's federal system.
In Canada, there has been a very strong priority put on federal-provincial consensus because there are only 10 provinces and 3 territories and 1 prime minister. They can all sit around a table together, and there is an expectation of consensus in those meetings. So the alternate argument is, if it hadn't been up to provinces in the first place, if it hadn't been an expectation of consensus that allowed the most fossil fuel dependent provinces to veto national action for a long time, would it have been the federal government that stepped in years earlier, rather than waiting for that provincial innovation dynamic to take hold? And we can't know. I think it's hard to say, but on balance, I would still say that the obstruction dynamic has prevailed and slowed Canada's response to climate change down more than that innovation dynamic has helped.
National and subnational consensus is challenged when fossil fuel production and the accompanying economic benefits are regionally concentrated. This situation permits oil-rich provinces to act in their own self-interest, which may obstruct national policy initiatives.
So in the Canadian case, federalism exhibits very few of its benefits for climate change policymaking for one simple reason, and it starts with A, Alberta. If you have an Alberta, then if you decentralize climate change policy, as it was for a substantial period of time, then Alberta is going to run away and it's going to play a shirking role. Other people will be doing their bit. Alberta won't do its bit. And because Alberta's contribution is so enormous and growing, it swamps the efforts of other jurisdictions. It doesn't negate the efforts, but it does swamp them. And really, you're only going to get effective action across the country if it's undertaken by Ottawa, by the central government, because there's no other way to rein in Alberta.
In 2018, the Canadian federal government did just that, passing the Greenhouse Gas Pollution Pricing Act. After Alberta, Ontario, and Saskatchewan challenged the legislation, in 2021, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that the federal government's national price on carbon pollution was constitutional. For Catherine, this was a significant development in the advancement of Canadian climate policy.
I think it was a hugely important moment, not just the court decision, but the federal government's assertion of its authority. Because what we have tended to see is this rule of consensus, and that national standards have been watered down, or it's been left to the provinces to do their own thing. And in fact, we didn't have federal regulation most sources of greenhouse gas emissions in Canada until this relatively recent carbon pricing law. The Supreme Court upheld it against objections of several provinces. British Columbia was the only province that intervened in that Supreme Court decision in support of minimum national standards. And the Supreme Court held that the federal government had authority to establish a benchmark carbon price because of the risk of economic competition among provinces and the fact that some green leaders could make progress, but that progress would be undone by laggards who allowed their emissions to increase. The Supreme Court was quite explicit in actually weighing in on some federalism dynamics that we have seen and that one might see in a federal system.
Canada's challenges with regional resource concentration are illustrative of dynamics seen in other federations as well. However, this challenge is particularly prominent in the Canadian case.
At the end of the day, it would appear that all you can do is do what Ottawa has done for years and antagonize Alberta even more by dictating to them what they can and cannot do. Canada is an acute case. It's the worst example. Well, it's the best example, but the worst challenge because of the tar sands. Tar sands aren't a major resource in many countries at all. It really does make the Canadian situation a pronounced case of that shirking problem. You have one jurisdiction that is so economically dependent on such an emitting source. It's a nasty one. In a sense, it's the outlier. It's not representative of the challenge federal systems face, though it is in the sense that other federations face more moderate versions of the same. Germany has states that are dependent on coal, and America has much more carbon-emitting states that certainly don't do what California does. And there's a similar thing in Brazil, where a number of the states have been taking action, again, in the absence of leadership from the central government that was opposed to climate change action. But whatever savings they could make were swamped by the increase in climate change contributions from further deforestation in the Amazon states. So again, federalism allows states that want to take action to take action, but if they're not the ones causing the problem, that's not going to do a lot of good. But the Canadian case is an extreme version.
If you want to learn more about the often tricky federalism dynamics of climate change policy in Canada, you can read Professor Harrison's climate governance policy paper, The Challenge of Federalism for Canadian Climate Policy. You can download it for free from the forum's website, forumfed.org, or use the link in the show notes. Check it out. In contrast to the Canadian experience, in 2014, the central government in Australia initially hindered the implementation of climate policy by rolling back some of the initiatives of previous governments.
The Australian case is one of the most positive from a federalism aspect, because in the Australian case, it would appear that the opportunities or benefits of federalism were most clearly displayed. What happened in Australia was a long period of time when the central government, the Commonwealth government in Canberra, was in the hands of the Conservative parties who were adamantly opposed to climate change action. And in fact, they came into office on a promise to axe the tax, the carbon tax that had been introduced by the Labor government just a couple of years previously. And they did that very promptly, eliminated the carbon tax. So for almost a decade, the central government was in the hands of a coalition of parties who were determined not to do anything about climate change.
Despite a lack of action from the central government, the states and territories developed their own climate change initiatives in an effort to fill the gap. But what specific measures did they take?
The states did as the federalism literature promises or predicts. They stepped up and took climate change action on their own. And they did so using a variety of tools and instruments. They don't have access to all the tools and instruments, but they had access to enough that they have led the way in Australia on taking mitigation action, particularly to reduce Australia's dependence on the burning of coal to generate electricity, which is the dominant form of electricity generation in Australia. What they launched was a variety of programs to promote the development of wind and solar renewable energy and the uptake of that by households and businesses. And they could do that in part because the states control the electricity generation systems. So they were in a position to put various incentives in place to promote the uptake of renewable energy sources. So Australian federalism has exhibited the best of federalism in that regard. And clearly, of the three areas in which federalism may facilitate climate change policymaking, the second one of those proved to be the most important, the ability of the constituent units to compensate for inaction at the central government level. And that's happened pretty much across the country. the Australian case is a good news case from that point of view.
As we heard in part one of our climate change series, political discourse plays an important role in fostering or discouraging climate action. The Malaysian case provides an interesting example of how a national government can create an incentivizing environment for the development of climate policy. But what kinds of instruments did the central government draw on to encourage positive action at the subnational level in Malaysia?
Of course, they must have the policy instrument to help this discourse become successful, and they use tax incentive.
Warathida Chayapa is a lecturer and assistant director at the School of Public Policy at Chiang Mai University in Thailand.
First of all, they set up the federal agency. It is called Malaysian Green Technology and Climate Change Corporation, MGTC. This is the government body at the federal level. The mission or the responsibility of this MGTC is to promote green growth, green technology, green service. They work as an expert, provide knowledge, know-how. They work as a consultant to the state government. So the state government who would like to be low carbon city or who would like to expand green growth, they can come to ask for the knowledge, expertise from MGTC. So the situation is cooperative between federal agency and the state government. They are the experts who give certificates to the green product or green service in Malaysia. And if the product is registered as green by this organization, the companies who own this product or the company who want to purchase this product become eligible to apply for tax incentive from the government. Tax incentive has two kinds. The first one is the tax reduction when you purchase the green product or green service. And also another one, tax income reduction. It means that if you are the one who produce and sell green products in Malaysia, you get some reduction in the income tax. Malaysia used tax incentive to stimulate the green growth, and it works. I would say it worked very well.
The discourse in Malaysia prompted subnational units to view green transition as an economic opportunity, which has led to positive competition in order to attract green investment to their states.
When the state government see the opportunity from climate change, especially climate change mitigation through the green growth expansion, they kind of compete among themselves. What I see the situation in Malaysia is the state governments compete with each other to set ambitious goals in terms of greenhouse gas emission reduction, in terms of try to set up the number of low carbon zones in their own territory. So they try to promote that, oh, in my state, there are this many of the low carbon zone to benchmark with each other and to promote that, oh, we are quite green state. And when they successfully do that, they extract the business who are also keen to do green business to go there and invest in that state. I found that the state government try to show that they are green, that they are low carbon city, and they kind of peer pressure, benchmark with each other, peer pressure that, oh, that state is doing that, so I should do it too. For example, Malacca, one of the states in Malaysia, is very active and ambitious in terms of climate change action, especially climate change mitigation through the expanding of the green growth. They even have their own climate strategy of Malacca City. Malacca has been known as the World Heritage City by UNESCO. There are Malacca and Penang that are listed in the UNESCO World Heritage City. So Malacca is very keen to gain recognition as the leader in sustainability as well.
Turning to Germany, the federal structure provides opportunities for governments to take action on climate change in various areas. However, cooperation between the different levels of government and other actors is crucial for the effective implementation of policy.
There is a possibility and an opportunity to do anything because in Germany, the federal level is compared to a lot of other countries and federations quite strong. There are measures to react in different areas, not just the main issues like security or educational policy, but on economic development as well. For example, you have the opportunity to decide regional development issues, city development, planning of infrastructure and things like this. And so these are important measures to use for actions against climate change. And you can't do it without support from the national level that you need. If there will be a policy which is not supporting it, then it's quite difficult. But on the other hand, if the national government tries to roll out a policy in this manner and on the regional level in the Länder in Germany, it will not be supported, then there's a problem as well.
Given the challenges we've seen in some other federations, how can this kind of cooperation work in practice?
I give you some examples concerning our situation in Bremen. Firstly, we have a big steel company, which is responsible for 50% of the emissions. And so there has to be a change up to hydrogen technologies. And this, of course, it's important that the company itself decides to go this way. But then we have and we develop the plans how to change the infrastructure, how to build different power lines and things like this to make a steel production with hydrogen possible. But it's a very costly thing. So the Länder level can and has to do a part of the financial activities, but it wouldn't work if on the national level there won't be a support from the national level. And so their cooperation is really, really important, and they have to be signed contracts and things like this. On the other hand, you can take the field of construction of buildings, maybe commercial used buildings or buildings for residents as well. There has to be a lot of change, and that's an issue of tax policy and help by this subsidize and things like this. But nevertheless, you need to develop the regulations for buildings and things like this, and that you do on the regional level, on the local level. And so it's very important that there is a highly cooperative political governance structure and the political will to cooperate.
But of course, even in instances of highly cooperative federalism, special attention must be paid to what is viable for people and businesses in terms of just transitions to green energy. What is feasible may vary from region to region. But the political discourse at all levels surrounding these issues must be conducive to change.
It's in general, a great transformation process we are in. And so, of course, people are hesitating here and there. And it's not supported on the social side. If you not think and discuss about just transition, then you lose in that development. And so, of course, there are different restraints on this way. And that's an important thing, that even if the central government says, let's go this way, it has to be possible on the local level, on the regional level, on the subnational level.
In this series, we've covered the climate governance dynamics of a handful of federal countries, but there are many more federations we don't have the time to explore here. Luckily, the Forum's new book, Climate Governance and Federalism, A Form of Federation's Comparative Policy Analysis, does just that. The book includes 14 case studies of climate governance in federal and decentralized countries around the world. If you're interested in learning more about governance and climate change, you can download it for free from the Forum's website, formfed.org, or use the link in the show notes. Check it out. In the countries we've covered so far, we've seen the importance of subnational units being able to take their own actions on climate change. But these areas can only do this if they have the autonomy and resources necessary to create tailored and relevant policies. In Malaysia, Malacca State has this ability, but in other countries, subnational units lack the capacity to act independently.
what I have seen the clear opportunity is the collaboration among different levels of government and also the authority that the state government can have to take care of to manage their own internal affairs. For example, the state government in Malaysia, let's take Malacca for example, has authority to sign any MOU, to sign any agreement with international organization and receive funding directly from those organizations to implement the projects in their territory. Not only that, they have authority to set up the company. It's called Government Link Company, GLC, to do green products or to do the solar farm, for example.
And India is interesting because, again, there has been some evidence of compensatory action by the states in India. But that then introduces a theme I raised earlier, which is that all federations are different. And one thing about the Indian Federation is it's quite centralized. So there are many ways in which the states don't have adequate powers and authority to take the kind of action they might want to take as far as climate change is concerned in India. It's a much more centralized federation. So in the ones where we've seen substantial compensatory action by constituent units, Canada, United States, Australia, in those federations, the constituent units have a whole range of powers at their disposal that are relevant to the area of climate change. But India is a bit different in that respect. South Africa was an extreme case of this, where the constituent units simply don't have the resources or power to take effective action at all.
While governments are undoubtedly the most significant players in developing and implementing climate policy, other stakeholders also play an important role in supporting sustainable change. The private sector both contributes to climate change and is an essential partner in the efforts needed to combat global warming.
We have failed abysmally to address climate change for more than 3 decades now, and a large part of it is resistance from the fossil fuel industry in particular and fossil fuel intensive industries, because it will cost them money. I mean, fossil fuels used as intended cause climate change. The source of energy is producing that CO2 molecule. So if we're asking the industry to fix climate change, it's basically saying stop being a fossil fuel industry. I think it's asking too much, expecting too much.
These private-public strategies, yeah, we've learned as well that they don't work if the public sector isn't going first and moving first and develop the answers. Nobody will change the power generation of his own house if the public houses won't change. There you have to develop good examples and have to show that it's possible.
On its own, the private sector may not be incentivized to transition away from fossil fuels. However, the public sector can implement regulations and provide private companies with transitional support.
Fossil fuels are great. They are a very cheap source of energy if you don't care about climate change. And as such, industries that are in the business of competing to get low-cost products on the market, and that's what most of them are doing, are not en masse going to move. And we've seen innovation, pockets of innovation, often that is companies within a sector that anticipate that government regulation will be coming. And when that regulation comes, they want to have a competitive advantage. But it still depends on that government regulation being plausible in the first instance and actually materializing, because otherwise we are going to go the route that we have, which is continuing to burn fossil fuels.
It's quite difficult, of course, because the private sector looks for its advantages and has not this cooperative view on competition. That doesn't work in a longer vision, because you have to develop collective actions. So you need, of course, to discuss with the private sector. You have to listen to their views and their problems on the one hand, but on the other hand, you have to have clear goals and clear visions how it has to go. Otherwise, it's impossible to do this way.
Having a clear vision on climate action requires an understanding of the wide-ranging impacts of climate change. But, as Warathida explains, climate literacy among stakeholders is sometimes lacking.
You will be able to adapt when you know what is the impact or what are the risks. But if you don't know what are the risks or what are the impact of climate change, then you will not be able to come up with adaptation plan. That's the first step. From my experience of doing the research and talk with people, stakeholders, politicians, even the politicians who are from the government side, they do not have good climate literacy, especially on the impact of climate change. Let me just give you one example. When you think about climate change impact, what kind of picture pop up in your head? Can you imagine that the people that I talk with, they still answer about the ice melting and polar bear get starved? They still have the perception that climate change impact happened far away from them. Something that happened in the North Pole or South Pole with the polar bear. They don't have the perception that actually climate change already happening around them. Fire, drought, food insecurity, flooding, sea level rise. For example, Bangkok, we will have problem with sea level rise very soon because our city is sinking from many factors, but our city is sinking. But do you think people know? No, I mean, they don't aware.
As we've seen, both governments and the private sector have a significant role to play when it comes to combating climate change. But what about individuals? There are different perspectives on how much onus is on individuals to adopt greener habits. Catherine and Warathida have contrasting views on this issue.
There are green consumers and green investors who are only willing to buy the low carbon products or put their money in fossil free investments. But most people are just trying to get by and they have limited resources and they want to get their family to soccer practice or get to work in an inexpensive way. And I don't think we can count on people spending more money or even doing the research on what the carbon footprint of different products are, because this is a common pool problem. If the exhaust pipe from everybody's car went into the passenger area, then I would be confident that people would take into account the pollution coming from their vehicle. But it goes out into the world where it affects, you know, over 7 billion people equally. And in those circumstances, I think it is expecting too much of individuals that they will be the consumers that lead this revolution. I think what is reasonable to expect of citizens is that they will support government policies that require that we all buy those kinds of products and that we all transform our economy collectively.
In terms of climate change, as an expert and the one who study and do a lot of research on climate change and climate change policy, I would like to say that if we want to really tackle the climate change issue, we don't need to wait for the policy from the government at all. We can start by eat less beef, unplug your phone when you're fully charged, bike to work. We don't need to, you know, do very ambitious action like install solar rooftop or buy EV car. We can start by ourselves with the very small activities that we do every day. And we don't need the policy from the government to tell us.
Throughout the series, we've explored how federal dynamics shape government, private sector, and individual responses to climate policy. We've seen the advantages and some of the challenges that federal systems experience. This raises the question, how does climate policy in federal states match up to the efforts of their unitary counterparts? As Catherine explains, it's not necessarily easy to compare federal countries with unitary ones when it comes to climate governance.
In practice, it tends to be more complicated than you would think to compare a unitary system and a federal system because countries vary on so many other things at the same time. So if we could find two countries that were identical, except that one was unitary and one was federal, then we could draw that conclusion. But some work that I've just been doing with a colleague in Norway, Guri Bang, we were comparing Canadian and Norwegian climate policy and policies with respect to fossil fuel production. And these are two countries that have a lot in common. They are wealthy. They have climate-concerned electorates. They have relatively ambitious Paris Agreement targets. They are both major fossil fuel producers for export. And so we thought it would be interesting to compare them. But in fact, they're not perfectly equal because Norway produces more fossil fuels per person. And the industry is a higher share of GDP in Norway than it is in Canada. So on one hand, we see differences between provinces and the federal government within Canada. But comparing the two national governments is complicated because Norway is kind of halfway between Alberta and the Canadian federal government in terms of the degree of dependence on fossil fuels.
While comparing federal and unitary responses to climate change can be difficult, researchers are beginning to identify variations in approaches. Orthita, for example, has explored differences between climate policy and governance in unitary Thailand and federal Malaysia. As she explains, Thailand has a strong national legal framework for climate action, but faces challenges with implementation at the local level, whereas the autonomy of the states in Malaysia gives them more flexibility in their approach to local policy.
Thailand recently is drafting the first Climate Change Act. I think this is the first country in Southeast Asia to have Climate Change Act. And the content of Climate Change Act is that we have penalty for the industry that do not declare greenhouse gas inventory. So this is the very breakthrough for Thailand, you know, but we are very good at implementing law regulation, but we are not good at finding opportunity in terms of economy or business. Thailand is a very good global citizen. Our government submit a pledge, a very ambitious pledge to cut down greenhouse gas emission. But then we have a problem to implement such goal, such policy. Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment is the focal point to implement climate change policy, but they don't have authority over other ministries. We have quite silo work. And the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment of Thailand cannot translate the climate change policy to the local level because the local government, the municipality office, under Ministry of Interior, different ministry, and they don't work together yet. So it turned out that we have good national climate policy, very good, very ambitious, but we don't have implementation at the local level yet. I don't see that ability in Thailand local government. We have decentralization as well in Thailand at the municipality level. But our municipality office does not enjoy such power, such authority to create company, to set up company and do the business. But in Malaysia, the state government have such power to do business by themselves and generate income. They don't need to only rely on the budget from the government, the central government.
Given that top-down policy implementation is typically more straightforward in unitary systems, are they better equipped to tackle climate change?
Well, one answer to that question is yes. Let's assume that the simplest, most efficient, and most effective single mechanism for reducing emissions is a reasonably punitive carbon tax. And that's most easily implemented by central governments. So in a unitary state, that would be very straightforward. They could go ahead and implement a punitive carbon price that would force, using price mechanism, a substantial change in energy usage patterns. But of course, that's contingent on there being a government that's going to do that. And that can happen in a federal system as well. So I began by saying yes, but I'll say no. I don't think there's any particular benefit to being a unitary state. And the difference, as I said, in a unitary state, if you don't have that kind of government, then there's no alternative. There's no other level order of government to take action. So in a best case scenario, unitary government might outperform a federal one, but things are rarely a best case scenario. So you're better off having a federal system where you've got a plan B, and your plan B is that the constituent units can take action in lieu of the central government's action.
So, if federal systems are well placed to support innovative policies on climate change, what do our experts think is needed to keep the momentum going?
I think that we can all learn from each other and from our processes. You can learn that you have to build up a plan, a strategy. And of course, you have to have the political majorities to realize it on the national level and then on the federal level. You can develop the very precise ideas. And you all have to do this, in my opinion, with the participation of the people on the local level. Otherwise, it won't work.
The thing is, we appreciate that Malaysian government set up such discourse, right? To have the climate change mitigation through the green growth. And also, I think for the short term and medium term, it's beneficial to the economic development of the state level or local government also can have the benefit from this policy. But I am very concerned in the long-term implication on sustainability. The economic green growth, right, that they want to have, it is still under the same economic philosophy that we need to consume to have GDP increase. We need to tell people to buy more, to consume more. And that's caused a problem to the environment in the past, right? If we continue consume without thinking about reducing our consumption.
So what do I think needs to happen? In practice, in the Canadian Federation, we need to stop expecting consensus, federal provincial consensus, given the very different economic stakes. We need to have courage as voters and as governments to move forward to actually reduce our emissions, which we have never done. And that will require a strong backstop at the federal level. We can't forget those who work in these industries that are going to be protected. We need to be pursuing a just transition, but that transition needs to happen because otherwise it's just going to get worse. There's no new normal.
As we come to the end of our two-part series, we asked our experts to sum up how they view the relationship between federalism and climate change.
In a federal structure, local government can develop successful measures and actions to mitigate climate change. But this can be done just with the participation of the people on the local level. That's a necessary thing. And that you can do in a better way in a federal organized society and a federal organized country than in a centralized structure.
Federalism has the potential to offer a number of benefits for climate change mitigation, particularly in circumstances where central governments are unwilling to take action. In circumstances where the central government is in the hands of parties who are opposed to climate change action, then federalism offers the scope for an alternative set of policymaking spheres. I think perhaps the best way is to say that the one benefit that federalism has exhibited is that fail-safe mechanism whereby the constituent units can step up and take action when a central government fails to do so or is resistant to doing so. And that is a benefit. You're not going to get any unitary state. However, that depends on the willingness of those constituent units to take that action.
I would say that federalism is a very complicated machine, and it's one with a whole bunch of different steering wheels on it. If you've got all of those different drivers with their own skill sets committed to going in the same direction, it can be fantastic. You can corral all of that expertise and have the best of all worlds. If they don't want to go in the same direction, the whole thing grinds to a halt. And we've seen that all too often.
That was Forum Fedcast. Huge thanks to our guests, Alan Fenner, Catherine Harrison, Warathida Chayapa, and Carsten Seeley. While this episode was being produced, Canada was experiencing another climate-related emergency, with its worst wildfire season since records began, which blanketed cities like Ottawa, Montreal, New York City, and Washington, D.C. in a smoky haze. So if we sounded a little husky in this episode, now you know why.
For more on the Forum's work on climate change and federalism, check out our website at formfed.org. You can find links to download the Forum's book, Climate Governance and Federalism, A Form of Federation's Comparative Policy Analysis, and Professor Harrison's paper, The Challenge of Federalism for Canadian Climate Policy, in the show notes and on the Forum's website. Stay tuned to the Forum's social media channels for more climate change and federalism content. You can find us on Twitter at FormFed and as the Forum of Federations on Facebook and YouTube. Drop us a line and say hi.
As always, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts on federalism and climate change to podcast@forumfed.org. Get in touch and tell us what we missed, and let us know what subject you would like covered on future episodes. For previous episodes of the podcast, just search Forum Fedcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Podbean. Recommend it to a friend. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review on your platform of choice. This episode was written and hosted by
Jamie Thomas
and me, Liam Whittington. It was produced by Liam Whittington and Xenia Wasim. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on Forum Fedcast.